Today's Veterans Radio is an encore presentation of Typhoon Cobra with Gary Lilly as the host. Veterans Radio is dedicated to all the men and women who have served or are currently serving in the armed forces of the United States of America. Today's program is brought to you by U.S. Wings, a U.S. manufacturer of the finest quality military leather flight jackets and much, much more. For more information about U.S. Wings, go to uswings.com. And the Marine Scholars Program at Ave Maria University, go to avemaria.edu for more information about this great scholarship program. From the studios of Ave Maria Radio and WDEO in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and around the world, this is Veterans Radio, and now here's today's host, former Navy Seabee, Chu Lai, Vietnam, 1966, Can Do, Gary Lilly.
And good morning, Dale. Thank you so much. That was Dale Thronberry, helicopter pilot. Who are you with, Dale, over there in country in Vietnam?
195th Assault Helicopter Company, Sky Chiefs.
And you guys did a pretty good job of flying in and out of Cambodia and dropping off special forces teams.
I was never there.
Oh. I forgot. And Matt Durr, getting to the point where you're no longer an intern, you're doing a great job in there.
Bob always says I'm the boss now. So.
You are a very good one at that. I want to say good morning to all our troops spread out around the world, keeping the world safe, the thin green and blue line that's doing such a magnificent job. Thank you. And to my veteran brothers and sisters, welcome home. And all you folks in other countries, I know that you're down there in Tasmania, Al, and Scotland and Brazil and all over the place. You know, thanks for listening in. Good morning, America. This is Veterans Radio. Got a great program lined up for you. It's called the Typhoon Cobra that took place December 18th and 19th, 1944. We'll have the captain and a crew member of the USS Dewey. Now, the USS Dewey is believed to have rolled over on its side more than any other ship in history and still came back up, and also recorded possibly the lowest barometric pressure ever recorded in the world. Quite a storm, and we're going to be talking to a couple of guys that were literally at times neck deep in it.
And, of course, that was Gary Lilly, and we're very proud to play his encore program today about the Typhoon Cobra. But also, we have a little announcement. Thank you very much. Da-da-da. Coming up on August or April 14th, that's next Saturday evening, is the Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310 Gary Lilly Annual Recognition Dinner. And they are trying to sell tickets to raise funds for all of the good things that the VVA does. And the tickets are $10. The dinner is going to be held at the UAW Hall on Textile Road in Ypsilanti, Michigan. And it's going to run from 6 o'clock till whenever. They are looking for people to buy tickets, so you can call Bob at here's a phone number, is 734-771-9501. Or you can email bobski9933@aol.com. That's for the VVA 310 Gary Lilly Annual Recognition Dinner. This is kind of a humorous gathering, because what they're going to be doing is using Gary's famous spaghetti and meatballs recipe, and Bob is in the studio with me. Bob Gould is in the studio with me, and I understand that you're going to help cook those.
Oh, yeah, but it can't be that hard to cook tomato sauce. You just put the tomatoes into a pan and add a little oil, a little bit of garlic, and I think that's about it. Some people put oregano in it, but that's Greek. Right.
Oh, picky.
I think that's very important. No, the Greeks get real upset about that. I should say the Italians, not really the Greeks.
I would say. Yeah. Anyway, this is going to be a major fundraiser for VVA 310, so we hope that you can come on out on April 14th at 6 o'clock, the UAW local Here's the number, local 898 Union Hall on Textile Road in Ypsilanti. Please, $10 is all it is.
I think it also points out to our listening audience, which is vast all around the world, that check with your local VVA, that's Vietnam Veterans of America, or your VFW, or the American Legion. Just, you know, you want something to do, you want to meet with other veterans, check and see when these organizations have these events.
Their events and their meetings. And most of them all have websites now. The other thing I wanted to mention is that our host station, WDEO and Ave Maria Radio, is having their fundraiser next week.
Boy, that's a biggie.
That's a real biggie.
That's very important
for all of us here at Veterans Radio.
Absolutely.
And, of course, all of those important here at Ave Maria Radio.
And you can go to AveMaria.com.
.net.
Okay.
Right, and make a donation, or if you are a listener.
And we want you to donate.
Yes.
Be sure and tell them who it's for.
That's right. And they're going to start taking donations and pledges at 7 o'clock on Monday morning. So from 7 until 7, Monday through Friday, you can call this number, 877-288-1077. That's 877-288-1077. And tell them that Veterans Radio told you to call that number and to make a pledge.
I was going to say something that'll get you to heaven, but no, I better not say that.
Not quite, but you got to listen to today's program, Typhoon Cobra with Gary Lilly, and we'll be back in just a moment.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu. Or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Veterans Radio, Surviving Typhoon Cobra, 1944, which was first broadcast on June 19th, 2010. Now we rejoin Gary Lilly and his guests.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and it's really my pleasure to welcome Captain Raymond Calhoun and Reverend Merle Eastman, two members, the captain and a crew member of the USS Dewey. I read a book called Halsey's Typhoon, which has some inaccuracies in it, I'm told, but it's just a remarkable story. And also a book written by Captain Calhoun that you might want to go out and find. It's called Typhoon, The Other Enemy. I'll start off with Captain Calhoun. Welcome, sir.
Welcome. Thank you very much. Good to be here.
please describe that typhoon for us. This one was, we lost three Navy ships, three destroyers, and over 800 men, and our aircraft carriers were burning, and it was pretty bad. Tell us about the typhoon, if you would, please.
Well, that's a big story to tell about.
Yeah, and you got 30 seconds.
this particular storm struck us beginning on the 17th of December, at which time we were refueling the destroyers that were accompanying the FAST carrier task force. And on the 17th, when they were supposed to refuel, it was so rough that fueling from another ship was simply not feasible. We found that we couldn't maintain station alongside of another ship close enough to allow the fuel hoses to stretch into the tanks. So we were having great difficulty, and we were seriously concerned about the level of fuel that was left in several of the destroyers that had been accompanying the carrier force a few days earlier. They were down to something like 10,000 gallons in one case, and that was on a ship that whose normal capacity was about 240,000 gallons. So he was practically out of gas. Anyway, on the 17th, we suspected on my destroyer that we were on the fringes of a typhoon. And by the evening of that day, we were convinced that we were running into it because there were some classic signs, including what was called a cross swell, and we were convinced that the storm was bearing southeast of our position. And all we knew about the next day was that we were scheduled to try again to refuel. Among ourselves on the Dewey, we concluded that that was simply pie in the sky. Anyone who thought we were going to be able to refuel on the 18th, when it was as rough as it was on the 17th, and getting rougher, was just kidding himself about the real circumstances. So when we went to bed that night, we, at least on the Dewey, concluded that we would not form up and try to fuel on the next day. Well, of course, that turned out to be untrue. We were scheduled to refuel again at 6 o'clock in the morning, and sure enough, at 6 o'clock, we were that time wide awake because of the turbulence of the sea, and we couldn't believe it, but we were forming up to try to refuel again. So we took a fueling course to the northeast, which in our opinion was going to run us on a collision course with the storm. And we actually steamed on that collision course for about an hour before it was determined that that course was not going to do it, that we would have to give up the idea of refueling that day, and at which time we turned south, or tried to, because at that point, say at about 4 o'clock in the morning, we began to get into the very guts of the storm, and sea conditions worsened to the extent that I had never seen them before. And we were encountering seas that were so high that when I looked out from the bridge of the Dewey to see another destroyer that was a little over a mile away, I couldn't see him because he was in the trough of the waves. And my height of eye above the water on the bridge was about 54 feet, and I could not see the top of his mast.
Captain, how high would you estimate the waves were?
We estimated that they were about 60 feet.
That would be a six-story building.
Yes, and there were some carrier skippers who reported that they had encountered 70 feet. Anyway,
in fact, they were getting green water over.
They were getting green water over their flight deck.
And that means that it's solid water, it's not spray.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
With the destroyer, your job was to screen for the carriers. And it was kind of hard for you to keep up with them, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, it would be hard to keep up with them on any day.
That's what I mean, right.
On that particular, in that weather, it was very hard.
And how much fuel would a destroyer go through when it was screening for carriers on a normal day? How long were you good
for? If they were conducting flight operations, I think it would have stretched it a bit to go 4 days without refueling, and because they were constantly making 30 or 32 knots in order to create enough relative wind over the deck to enable the aircraft to take off.
And what was the importance, other than running out of fuel, for having a full load of fuel on a destroyer when a major storm was hitting?
Well, destroyers are designed in such a way that unless the fuel tanks are considerably full, unless you have a reasonable amount of fuel aboard, like, say, 60% or something like that, you're going to be uncomfortable from the standpoint of the stability of the ship. The ship becomes top-heavy when the fuel is exhausted and not replaced.
When you say uncomfortable, that sounds like a doctor saying you're going to be a little uncomfortable during this procedure.
Yeah, well, when I say uncomfortable, I mean hanging on to something so that you didn't fall over.
Let me switch over to Reverend Eastman, who's sitting here in the broadcast booth. Oh, those big words always throw me. Reverend, you were working down below, were you not?
Yes, I was in the intercommunications room.
What was your job on the destroyer, the USS Dewey?
Well, I was an electrician's mate.
Which means that there's a lot of, I do realize, but people don't realize, you know, how much electricity there is on a ship that can go wrong. And were you having some issues with electricity during that storm?
Oh, at that point, yes. Yeah.
What was happening? I understand there was water getting on the control boards, even though that everything was battened down as tight as it could above you?
Oh, yes, but water still got in, and when we were rolling about 70 degrees is when Captain called down and said, everybody below deck, prepare to abandon ship. And that's when I left the intercommunications room and went into the officer's mess hall and helped the doctor lash tables and chairs down so that men wouldn't get hurt. And then from then on, I thought I was secure. I grabbed a hold of the voice tube that went to the bridge and sat on a sterilizing instrument and both pulled off the bulkhead, and I landed out in the middle of the dining room. But I didn't really get hurt at that point. That's when I went into the little passageway and sat down, put my feet up against one bulkhead and my back against the other.
The bulkheads, for the civilians out there, are those who have not been in the Navy. That's the walls, too.
That's right.
Okay, and the deck is the floor.
Right.
I was a CB, never set foot on a ship, but I used to love to play with the lifers by saying the floor and the wall and downstairs. Anyway, what was your feeling during the height of the storm, Reverend?
Well, my feeling was that we were going to be lost at sea. And I actually prayed for my family back home that when they got the word that I was lost at sea, that they would accept it and go on with their lives and make the best of it.
You were pretty, you went from being afraid to very calm, did you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
When you accept death, you become calm?
Yeah, I realized that it was all over, and I was ready for it.
Still in all, you're a reverend today.
Well, I am because of what happened that day, because when the ship was lying on its side, I heard a voice, definitely. That said, if I got you out of this, would you do anything I would ask you to do? And I was in no position to do any bargaining, so I did answer quite quickly and said, yes, I would. And then the voice said again, would you preach? And that threw me, but I didn't wait too long. I said I'd even do that. I knew my father was a pastor for years, very successful. And I had nothing against the ministry, but I just never felt called until that day. And then I was really called, and that's when I decided I would be a minister.
Captain?
Yes, sir.
At any time during this storm, were you terrified?
No. No, I was convinced that we were not going to capsize.
Now, you were over on your side. The ship was on its side, and you were still convinced that you weren't going to?
That's right.
What?
Maybe I was a little crazy in those days.
Well, that helps.
But anyway, no, I never did believe we were going to go down.
When the ship rolled over on its side, how long would it stay there?
Well, it seemed as though it stayed there for a half an hour, but it probably was no more than about 2 or 3 minutes.
Those
were agonizing minutes because we didn't know if they would write themselves. It would write itself, but I never believed that we would do that. And when I sent the word to the people who were below decks that they should be prepared to abandon ship, I was simply being ready,
right,
in the event that that happened. But I didn't believe it was happening.
Well, it's when people hear that the secret is disclosed that this country has plans to invade another country, it's not that they plan on doing it. It's just that in the military, especially, you have to be ready for any set of circumstances.
Right.
And that's what you're saying that you did. Was,
yes.
You know, in the event that it came, you didn't want to catch anybody by surprise, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, that came about because the bosun, my warrant officer, who was much older than the average crewman, came to me during the storm and said, "Captain, are we going to abandon ship?" And I said, "No. So long as the Dewey's going to hang in there, we're going to hang into the Dewey."
And speaking of hanging, I read an account, and I put in a flyer that you were hanging by a stanchion. Was it you or another officer was hanging?
That was me, and I was frequently aware that my squadron commander, who was a passenger on our ship, we were his flagship, he and I would be both hanging vertically from a stanchion, which was normally vertical, and he was hanging from the base of his bridge chair, and both were facing each other, probably 3 feet apart, conducting conversations about that. In one case, he asked me if I thought that I would be able to manage in the event that I got into the water. And I said, "Yeah, I thought so." And he said, "Well, I don't think I could." He said, "Of course, you're younger than I am." And then he said, "But I'm not going to worry about it because my insurance is all paid up."
Did you ever look down between your feet when you were hanging?
Indeed, we did. And
what would you see?
In fact, I used that expression to describe the number of degrees we rolled when the representatives of the Bureau of Ships came aboard the ship in Ulithi when the storm was over and we returned to port. The first thing that happened was that these new ship's technicians, all of them captains, four stripers, and the first thing they asked me was, "How far did you roll?" And I knew from experience that if I told them it was X number of degrees, they would proceed to tell me that I couldn't possibly have rolled that far. So I avoided using a number of degrees, and I said, "I don't know how many degrees we rolled, but I do know that I was hanging from a stanchion with my hands, and the stanchion was normally vertical, and I was looking down past my feet, which were clear of the deck, and past my feet, I was looking right through the starboard bridge window. So had I let go, I would have fallen directly into the sea." And they said, "Oh."
Well, then I didn't make a mistake on the fly.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right.
Amazing. What about the helmsman? Now, that guy he couldn't let go of anything.
No, and he had a terrible time because his footing was insecure, and he would find himself at times hanging on to the wheel, and his feet clear of the deck.
So it was his weight that was keeping the wheel over.
Well, no, he would then have to grab something and pull himself back onto the deck so that he could turn the wheel back.
Did he ever get water inside the bridge?
No, I read in one of the other books that we had a considerable level of water. I don't recall any appreciable collection of water in the pilot house, maybe 2 or 3 inches.
You did write a book about it. What is the title of
your book? Oh, yeah, the book is called Typhoon, the Other Enemy. It's now out of print, although you'll find scads of copies on the Internet.
So just do a search, and I read that book. The Reverend loaned me his copy, and I read Halsey's Typhoon. And despite the fact that it had some errors in it, the story is so dramatic.
It's very well written and very full of drama.
Drama is yes. What were our losses in that storm, in that typhoon, Captain?
Over 700 men, well over 100 aircraft, and 3 destroyers, the Hull, Spence, and Monahan.
How many survivors were there from the Hull, Spence, and Monahan?
Well, altogether, there was something like 60 or so. I think the Tabor, DE, that did most of the rescue work, recovered 55 people. There were 2 or 3 other destroyers, each of whom picked up 2 or 3.
I did make a mistake.
I think a total of about 70 would probably be a little excessive.
I did make a mistake in the flyer in that I thought that the Dewey had picked up 2 or 3, but you're telling me that you weren't able to pick up survivors?
No. And I should make a specific mention of that. I was on the bridge, of course, throughout all of this, and we had encountered the Tabor earlier that evening. We both came out of the center of the storm at about the same time, and it was like emerging from a bucket full of steam. 1 minute we were in the midst of this cauldron of spray and spume and flying water, and the next minute we were out into the open, still in very rough seas and high winds, but without the limited visibility. And he emerged about 1,000 yards behind the Dewey, and when he came out, he sent me a signal by light saying, "I have just lost my mast." And I sent him a signal and said, "Cheer up, we've just lost our stack."
So you lost one of your funnels.
One of the funnels.
And you think that may have helped you survive?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it did make a difference. It lowered the center of gravity, of course, because that much weight was now down on the deck. And the sail area of the stack just ceased to exist, so the wind did not have the stack to blow against. And the upshot of all of that was that we were a little bit more comfortable in the way we rode.
I love that comfortable word.
he sent me a signal saying he would like to know the course to Ulithi, and we reported that to him, and from then on he continued to steer a course slightly to the left of our course. I didn't know why he was doing that, but in any case, by about 11 o'clock that night, we had lost sight of him, but about 11 o'clock I could see the loom of a searchlight, and I assumed that light was from him, and that he may have been engaged in rescuing survivors. And we heard snatches of his conversation to some other ship. I don't know what ship he was talking to, but on the voice radio, he used the word survivor. duty in the direction of his light and proceeded to close him and assist in the rescue effort. When we took that new course, it was directly into the sea, and so we began to swim. If you know what that means on a destroyer,
I do.
The bow goes up and points skyward at an angle of like 30 degrees or more. And then it's as though someone cut the rope to let it fall. And it slams down into the sea with a shattering sound and a shuddering movement. So you feel as though you're going to lose your teeth.
Captain, we're going into a break. And Dale, there's a photograph in the collection of a cruiser that lost its bow in the in another typhoon.
That was the Pittsburgh.
You're listening to Veterans Radio on WDEO 990 AM, coming to you over the Ave Maria Radio Network. The story of the USS Dewey and Typhoon Cobra. We'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant Roy Harmon, although wounded twice, continued his assault on the enemy machine gun emplacements. Details after this.
On the way to your college degree, you hit some roadblocks. You decide it's time to change direction. The Air Force can help. We offer educational assistance, high-tech job training, and experience. The credits you've earned may help you start your Air Force career at a higher rank, and we'll pay off your student loans up to $10,000 if you qualify. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
Harmon was acting squad leader when heavy machine gun fire from German positions stopped his company's advance and pinned down one of the platoons. Ordered to rescue the platoon, he led his squad forward against three key positions. His squad fired tracer bullets in an attempt to set fire to the three haystacks. Harmon ordered his squad to hold their position and began a one-man assault. Carrying white phosphorus grenades, Harmon crept to within 25 yards of the first position. He set the haystack afire with a grenade, and when two of the enemy attempted to flee, he killed them with his machine gun. Crawling toward the second machine gun emplacement, he was wounded, but continued to advance and destroyed the position with hand grenades, killing the occupants. He then attacked the third machine gun. About halfway to his objective, he was again wounded, but he struggled ahead until within 20 yards of the machine gun nest, where he raised himself to his knees to throw a grenade. He was knocked down by direct enemy fire. With a final effort, he again rose, hurled a grenade, and fell dead, riddled with bullets. His grenade set the third position on fire, destroying it. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Today's Veterans Radio is brought to you by U.S. Wings. U.S. Wings is a U.S. manufacturer of the finest quality military leather flight jackets and much, much more. For more information about U.S. Wings, go to uswings.com or call them at 800-650-0659. That's 800-650-0659. uswings.com, a veteran-owned company. Just a reminder that you are listening to an encore program of Veterans Radio on Typhoon Cobra and the USS Dewey with host Gary Lilly. And now back to the program.
We're back on Veterans Radio with Captain Raymond Calhoun, captain of the USS Dewey during the Typhoon Cobra, in which the United States Third Fleet lost tremendous losses, and Reverend Merle Eastman, who was down below deck. Reverend, you, we're going to get back to finishing up that story, Captain, but Reverend Merle Eastman, I'm just going to say Merle, has a certificate called the 80-degree rollers. Could you read that for us?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I'm not sure who had the greatest hand in this. Maybe the captain had some of it, but I do know that a man named Pierce drew the picture and also gave the scroll on it. To all non-believers, Know ye that Eastman M.J. was a member of the USS Dewey, DD-349, member of the Clear when she was caught in the fury of a tropical typhoon on December year 1944. On this date, His Royal Majesty, next to Neptunus Rex, came put the ship to the test before accepting her into that group of truly great ships of the Navy. The barometer dropped to 2730. The wind rose to 125 knots, and mountainous waves towered over the tiny vessel, causing a roll to starboard many times. At the climax, the ship was subjected to a roll of 80 degrees plus, and the hatch of Davy Jones' locker opened wide to receive the sturdy ship into her gallant crew. At this crucial moment, when Neptunus was ready to take his new member before the raging sea, an angel of the Lord came forth, righted the ship, and watched over it through the remainder of the mightiest storm in naval history. All hands witnessed the evidence of their salvation, for the port yard arm was bent where the hand of God had touched the ship.
Captain, did you have any part of that writing?
I'm very familiar with that writing. Yes, I signed that certificate when it was first made, and I remained in contact with Sam Pierce, who designed it and wrote it for many, many years. In fact, he's still alive in Atlanta, head of an engraving firm there. Well, and I should continue. I'll get back to the story of the rescue in a minute, but I wanted to mention that the day after the storm, the morning of the 19th, I was standing on the bridge watching what was going on down on the main deck where people were clearing away wreckage and trying to repair some of the superficial damage. And one of our signalmen, whose nickname was Preacher, because at that time he was the lay preacher on the ship. In other words, he gave his best to do the divine services every Sunday. And Preacher came over to me as I was standing on near the flag bags on the starboard side of the bridge and said, "Captain, what do you think got us through the storm?" And I said, "Oh, I think it was probably a number of factors." I said, "In the first place, the engineers remained at their posts, and that was a big factor. Had they deserted their station, which happened on some other ships, we would undoubtedly have capsized." And I said, "Further, the ship was in good material condition. We had patched her up pretty well. What did you think did it?" And he said, "Oh, there's no question in my mind, Captain." He said, "Just take a look up there at that port yard arm." So I turned my head and looked up, and certainly, sure enough, the port yard arm was bent up at an angle of 20 or 30 degrees. And I said, "Well, what in the world could have bent the yard arm in that direction? We were rolling in to starboard, and that would have meant that the port yard arm couldn't have gone into the water." And he said, "Oh, there's no doubt about what caused that. That's where God reached down and grabbed hold of us and pulled us back up." And really, as a result of that conversation, when I first wrote the manuscript for the book, I titled it "The Miracle of the Dewey." And for some reason or another, the Naval Institute Press decided that they would rather have the title "Typhoon, the Other Enemy." The other enemy, of course, being the Japanese. So anyway, that's that's my story about the hand of God reaching us. I told Preacher that solution as to how we survived was good enough for me.
You guys did seem to have a little bit of extra help there. You had tried to have, I read an account, I've done so much reading about this, it's fascinating, and the beauty of the internet, oh, you just hit Google and you type in a couple of keywords and you come up with stuff. I read an account in the naval records of the man that you had told to cut off the yardarm.
Oh, yeah.
And he said that it was a good thing that you didn't, because he thought it would have come down and poked a hole in the ship.
Exactly.
Now, you had said that earlier in one of our conversations, and
yeah.
He was saying the same thing. Reverend, what has the after effect been in your life?
Well, of course, it changed my life entirely, because I did go into the ministry as soon as I prepared for it, and I've had a great ministry. I retired three different times, didn't have a day off, went from one church to another, and then I took a couple of interim pastorates, and so at about 80, 83, I kind of hung it up. But I've been volunteering at the VA hospital for about 11 years now. I've racked up about 5,000 hours. And I enjoy that. Every day I go into the rooms of the new patients and visit with them and leave gifts that we have volunteered to us. And so my ministry kind of keeps going on, although I don't go in as a chaplain. I used to, because they had a program they called assistant chaplain, but I still do that type of work.
What about your your attitude? After Vietnam, I find it very hard to listen to people complain about petty little things. What about how has that affected you from an attitude standpoint?
Well, I really don't appreciate that kind of talk, it's amazing that in the veterans hospital I find very little of that. Occasionally you'll find a person that's going to gripe no matter what, but basically our hospital does a great job, and I appreciate the fact that they've taken care of me so many times. I know I would have been bankrupt years ago had I not had
your prepaid health insurance.
Yeah, and I went to the VA hospital in Allen Park for 6 months, not long after the war, and they took good care of me, and I've been going there ever since.
Well, we have an excellent VA hospital here in Ann Arbor, and a lot of the doctors rotate in and out, most of them probably from the University of Michigan Medical Center, which is about a half a mile away. But the staff, I can't say enough for the staff. And you're right about veterans. Veterans don't complain about petty things.
No.
Because they've seen what's important in life. With a lot of veterans, there's that the dates of important happenings during a war, with grunts, it would be battles and all that. They kind of go into a bunker up, is what it said. But do you remember the typhoon and those particular dates?
Oh,
December 18th and 19th?
Very definitely. The 19th, I remember especially because we had pork and beans for breakfast. We had no way of preparing breakfast. And so year on the 19th, I have pork and beans for breakfast. And I tell people that was the best breakfast I've ever had in my life.
Oh, you have them cold, do you?
Yeah, I never expected it. For a little while, my kids would participate with me. Finally, they said, "Dad, is it okay if you celebrate by yourself?" They didn't care for the cold beans, but I still like them.
You know, Captain, we're going to have not enough time for you to finish up that story until after the next break. The final segment, we'll have you finish that up. But
Now,
what about you on the anniversaries of the typhoon?
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned someone who's apparently wrote an account about the storm, and one of our shipmates, his name was Steve Jordan. He was the ship fitter, and Steve had indicated that he thought that we should cut off the gun director, and I had nixed that, told him that I didn't think we should do it. And anyway, as a result of his involvement in the storm, he used to call me every 18 December and say, "Captain, this is Steve Jordan. You know what day this is?"
And of course,
yes.
He probably did.
Yeah, I was always well aware of where we had been on the 18th of December, 1944. Steve used to call me every year. And later in his life, he used to come visit me. So I was in touch with Steve Jordan until he died about 2 years ago.
Again, I'm going to refer back to the friend of mine that was the grunt in the 101st Airborne, the Ashaw Valley. Their company commander. Nobody made a decision without consulting with him first. You're listening to Veterans Radio, coming to you on the Ave Maria Radio Network. We'll be right back. Captain, tell us, pick up again where you were trying to get involved in the rescue.
Yeah, we proceeded in the direction of the light, thinking that that's where the rescue effort was going on. And I was called from the Commodore's stateroom with a question from him as to, "What in the hell are we doing?" And I said, "Well, we're on our way to assist the Tabarer. It seems that he may have some survivors in the water." And he said, "Well, you're the skipper. You do what you think is correct, but I would remind you that we took some terrible beatings this morning and this afternoon. We don't know what kind of damage we have done to the keel and the structure of the ship. We can see other damage, which leads me to believe that there is more serious damage that we haven't yet uncovered. So give some thought to that, and then make up your mind as to what you do." Well, it didn't take me long to come to the conclusion that he had much more experience than I did, and that he was undoubtedly correct in estimating that we had probably done some damage to the structure of the ship, and that to continue on that course, repeatedly beating down on the bow, ran the risk that the ship would break in half, which had happened to another ship not long before that. And so I turned around and decided not to go in the direction of the Tabarer, because we had probably done damage to our own ship that would greatly endanger us. And later, when we went to Iwo Jima and became engaged in gunfire support of the Marines, the ship's skin opened up, and we had cracks in the skin of the ship, and we also had broken transverse frames. These were the ribs of the ship, and on each side of the ship, both port and starboard, there were four or five transverse web frames that were broken at the weld, right at the turn of the bilge. And so it was absolutely true that had we continued on that course, banging ourselves into the trough every time we came down from the crest, we would have probably broken the ship in half.
Some photographs have come up of some of the ships, and they look pretty ratty, to use a phrase. They look pretty bedraggled. The force of the wind was so hard that it was taking some of the paint off, is what I read.
True.
That, like sandblasting.
Yes, and if you push, if you expose your face above the bridge bulwark, it would cause capillary bleeding. So your face would come away with these little pinpoints of blood, just as though you had been stuck with a pin.
We're seeing a photograph right now of the USS Tabor, which is minus its mast, and it's looking in pretty rough shape, too. That was really heroic, what they did in picking up
the
survivors. You know, I always believed that if you're in the water in a typhoon, at least you're free of the sharks. But from what I understand in the reading, the sharks were still up there.
Oh, they were, yeah. Yeah. Several of the people who would have otherwise survived succumbed to shark bite.
My gosh. Merle, is there something that we haven't talked about that you would like to bring up about that storm?
Well,
caught you by surprise.
Not really, but I had an awful lot of confidence in the captain, and I knew that he was going to do the best he could, and we'd leave it all, the rest of it, in the Lord's hands. But I was just thinking a little bit about the times that I heard the captain talk. I'll never forget the day that he came on the fantail and talked to all of the fellows that weren't on watch, that he said the next day we were going to drop a bomb on Japan that was going to end the war. There wasn't a man standing there that believed it, and we wondered if he even believed it, but sure enough, it was the next day that they dropped the first bomb, and that probably would have finished it, but they dropped the other one.
Captain Calhoun, how did you know that? This is the first time hearing about it. That was so secret.
To be honest with you, I don't even remember that. My 96-year-old brain seems to have lost that particular fact.
96 years old. You sound like you're 60. Do you look as good as you sound?
I'm not going to answer that question.
Might incriminate you.
Captain.
I want to say that I admired Merle. He made a commitment at that time, and he kept it. And he kept in touch with me for many, many years. In fact, I went to see him when I was still living in Minnesota, and he was in Michigan somewhere. I don't remember where we met, Merle, but it was good to see you, and always good to hear from you.
Well, that goes both ways.
Captain, what he said about you was not just said about you for the air. He and I have talked in private. We're in the same VFW post, and we also talked while preparing for this program, and he said the same words to me that when they didn't go out over the air. Is there anything that you would like to talk about, Captain? We've got a little under 3 minutes. I should say a little over two. Is there anything you would like to talk about?
Well, I'll just say that the Dewey's survival, of course, was due to God's grace. There's no question about it. And the title, the Dewey's Miracle, would have been, I think, much more appropriate. In any case, I wanted to acknowledge the wonderful dedication and service of the crew. They all stuck to their assigned stations. They all did what they were supposed to do. None of them panicked. It was great to be the skipper of a ship whose crew was as dependable as that crew was.
Merle said that you were an easy guy to get along with, but everybody always knew that you were the skipper. I had a battalion commander that was that way, and I've got to tell you that some of the things he did, I'd have walked through fire for that man. So I think it comes from the top on down, and I'm not just saying that because we're on the air also.
Well,
I know. I put you on the spot by complimenting.
Well, just let me say before we close, you're opening a new vista to me. I was not aware that you were on the air, and I congratulate you for the way you handled this program, and I think it's wonderful that you're dedicating it to veterans. It's important that the kids of today know more than they do now about World War II. My final statement would be that the kids of today, in the meantime, are proving themselves to be every bit as great as the great generation.
We have some wonderful kids in the military right now. I've interviewed a number of them. There's some in the VFW post, and they're the best I've ever seen, as good as I've ever seen. Captain Raymond Calhoun, thank you so much. Skipper of the USS Dewey in World War II, the skipper at least during the time that was most critical, the Typhoon Cobra. Thank you for being on Veterans Radio. Reverend Merle Eastman, thank you also for coming on board. Can't get the old Navy slang out. Until then, you are dismissed.
And you've just finished listening to an encore program of Veterans Radio, Typhoon Cobra. And joining me on the line right now is Gary Lilly's brother, Ben. Ben, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Yeah, thank you, Dale. I can't tell you how great it was to hear my brother's voice and the great job that you guys continue to do. And God bless you and Bob Gould and the new gentleman coming on board, to use Gary's words.
Yeah.
And it was just so great to hear my brother's voice again.
Well, thank you, Ben, so much. And it was such a pleasure to share his life with you.
All right.
Oh.
You have a good day.
I will. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Ben.
Bye-bye.
And also joining me on the line right now, I believe, is Bobski from the VVA 310. And, Bob, I think we've got about a minute to go. Welcome back to Veterans Radio. Tell me about Gary's dinner coming up.
Yes, this Saturday we have our annual VVA Chapter 310 recognition dinner, and this year we've renamed dinner to the annual Gary Lilly VVA Chapter 310 recognition dinner in honor of Gary. You know, Gary used to always make the his famous Gary Lilly meatballs, and we're going to have the same Gary Lilly meatball recipe this Saturday.
Well, it should be exciting, and we're hoping that people will come out. That's 6 o'clock on the 14th. At the UAW Hall on Textile Road in Ypsilanti, Michigan.
That's correct.
Right, and give us a call if you get a chance to do that. Thanks, Bob. I'm sorry I don't have any more time to give you today, but we will do that. I got another message from someone. Joe from Big Boy wants to thank the EMS guy for helping him out in an accident last week. And next week, we've got a program called Soldier Dogs. We're going to be talking about military dogs and their training. Until then, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of this program or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.